Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
2023, you guys, and I'm winging it. Hi, it's Jackie Cation. Welcome to the Dork Forest. That's the website, The Dork Forest, if you like a determiner. Dorkforest.com also works. JackieCation.com has all of my stand-up information. Like, it has videos, it has pictures, it has links to this podcast and to my other podcast with Lori Kilmartin. It has a merch store that has Dork Forest t-shirts. It has all of my stand-up merch and all of my CDs and DVDs. So, that's what you know about websites. There's an opportunity, because we're in the new year here, that you can donate to the Dork Forest. I don't have a Patreon. I don't have anything really set up, though I understand you can set up on PayPal a monthly if you wanted to. You could donate and be of to support the show. This is the 17th season, the 17th year I've been putting this stuff out. It's free, but if you have money and would like to throw me some money, boy, howdy. There's a PayPal, there is at my email address, actually, jackie@jackiecation.com, which you can also email me and tell me how much you're enjoying the show. You can also do Venmo if you'd like, which is just Jackie Cation, no hyphen, all one word, picture of this person, me. And then I think that's it. I think I have Zelle, but it's too complicated. Other than that, let's do the credits. Patrick Brady, still in, fixing the audio all these years later. Give it up to Patrick Brady. That's what a lot of your donations support, by the way, because I like to share the wealth. And then Vilmos, he does the websites. And Mike Rickberg wrote and sang that song. Composed and sang that song with his wife now, Sarah. And at the end, he sings the Mexican Hat Dance, which is always fun. Anyway, I'm sure there's more to it. There's a band camp that has a bunch. It has like a stand-up storytelling album that was never released. It's there's also a bunch of live episodes that many of them are free. There were 200 episodes that were not pre-recorded, and I sort of culled through those, and I pulled like 17 of the best ones. There's an album collection of that, 17 hours of Dork Forest. If you run through all of the episodes, go to bandcamp.com, Dork Forest, or Google those words, and you'll find it. Anyway, there's probably more. I can't remember any of it, but you're doing great. Feel free to enjoy the show. Hey, Jackie Cation here. I'm in my garage. Very exciting. Oh my God, Christy, I forgot to find out how to pronounce your last name.
It's Buccelli.
Buccelli.
I wish it was Buccelli. That would be so.
Buccelli. Yeah, Buccelli has kind of an Italian vibe, or Michelle.
Kelly, kind of. I even like. I should have just changed it. It's too late now.
Buccelli. Christy Buccelli, mm-hmm. Ladies and germs, welcome to the program. Christy,
thank you for having me.
Buccelli has a show. It's all Denver, right? This is all Rise Comedy.
Yes. I mean, I travel around, but I'm a Denver-based comic.
Denver-based comic.
I feel like I open for you every time. Yeah.
Every time
I open for you at Comedy Works, which is so lovely. And your audiences are wonderful.
Thank you.
I've been working on a one-woman show that has been my main push right now, and that will be coming out in June. Like, it's already done
I didn't get your handle for Instagram and all that. What is...
Yeah, it's The Joke Mentor.
Oh.
Because I teach comedy classes at Rise Comedy here in Denver, and
is it Mentor, MENTOR?
Yes.
The Joke Mentor.
It kind of sounds like it would be like a comedian supervillain a little bit, but.
Sure. It's a little Jeff Ross. How's that coming
out? Yes.
How's your mentoring coming?
Yeah.
I'd like to say it is not that. Christy?
It is
Buccelli, not. Not doing the creepy.
Not like that. No.
Not like that. No. Mentoring, just mentoring. So
yeah,
you're doing them. Yeah.
Yeah. My students are all ages, not just like 19-year-old females. So
14.
So
that's
sure.
that's yeah. the important. That's the important. You're not looking for a 14 year old fella.
I'm not.
Or no. young. You're not looking for a child that's on the cusp of adulthood. That's what I always say about Jeff Ross. He likes really old children. Ew. Okay. So.
But yeah, I have a one woman show that I've been working on, and actually, I did write some work today. We're going to talk about World War One. Which I did write some World War One stuff into the show. So I was excited.
That's how much you like World War One?
Yeah, it's something that I have I studied it in college like quite extensively. I was just I went to be a history teacher in school. I am technically licensed here in the state of Colorado.
And so then, So you went and your degree is in history or also teaching?
Yes.
European history
degree, teaching certification. That was my emphasis. Yeah. That was my emphasis. And I have to give a shout out right away to Joan Kleinfelter at Northern Colorado University because she is the one that gave me she was so passionate about it. It's why I love it even now. And it still sticks with me.
Interesting. Yeah. World War One, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
The Great War. The war to end all wars. 1914.
It was really the war to start all the wars. The modern wars. They were wrong about that. But
right. So was it a big switch in the kind of warfare it was? Everybody was still lining up, right?
Yes. So, I was trying to answer that question because you were like, I wouldn't say I love it.
Oh, but right. You're just fascinated.
Because it's it is horrifying. And my best friend, even the other day, she had turned on All Quiet on the Western Front, the remake that came out, and she was it took me 15 minutes and I was like, I had to turn this off. Why does Christy like this? So I would not say I like it. I think that it's, I find it fascinating. It's like a butterfly effect. So everything can be drawn back to really every modern conflict and most of our problems and all the patterns that we repeat were all started there in so many ways. And I just find it so fascinating that we have not learned our lessons, perhaps.
Right. No, we're talking over 100 years. So it started because somebody got assassinated. Am I right?
Yes, correct. Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And that's the wildest thing is this one. I mean, it really was called the shot heard around the world because it's this one bullet killing one man led to World War One, the Great Depression, the World War Two, the Cold War. So he was he was Austrian.
Austria.
The crown archduke is a crown prince. And
so not the king or the leader of the country, not even the leader of Austria.
No, but I think he would have been eventually, but he wasn't yet.
Okay. And there was a different king?
I think it was just his dad or whatever.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
It's Archduke is just the name of prince is there.
Okay.
I believe. And this was part of the Austria-Hungary. They were huge at this point and they had territory all the way into Poland and parts of the Eastern Bloc that we know of now, all the way down to the Balkans and Serbia and things like that. And they had just tons. Can you hear that?
No.
Okay, good. My neighbors are yelling in the hallway. So
all right.
They're having their own great war right now. Okay, anyways, just making sure. Okay, cool. And then they were Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, Sophie, were down in Serbia in the Balkans and they were kind of doing sort of a JFK situation.
Where they were just
a motorcade
touring or okay.
Yeah, sort of parade around. I don't know.
Okay. So there was some sort of weird meet and greet. That's what the trip was about, but they were in an open car motorcade.
It was just, it's back in 1914. So they're pretty open cars at that point. Right. But so this kind of political underground rebellion group called the Black Hand had planned on doing.
They're really called the Black Hand?
Mm-hmm.
Because that is a faction that fights Daredevil in the Marvel universe. Keep moving. Well, okay. Yeah.
No, it's great. They're called the Black Hand. And actually, like, it was this 16-year-old kid that had been recruited to kill. And they actually had thrown bombs at the Archduke's car.
Okay.
And they missed and it landed at another car killing people. So he had a narrow miss and it was like, oh my God, like,
thank
awful.
God I lived. Yes.
Right. And then they went back to, like, I don't know, the embassy or wherever they're hanging out, and the Archduke, I don't know I still cannot figure this out, but he was like, oh, well, it was just ego. This whole thing is about male ego. I think that's also why I'm so fascinated.
The Archduke said that?
No.
Or are you saying it's about male ego?
I'm saying that the Great War is just
I was
what
like,
happens.
That feels super awoke, awakened.
No.
Okay.
No, this is my, I think that's why I'm so fascinated by it, is because it just shows the dangers of the male ego forever and ever.
Oh, yeah.
Most war does, but he was like, oh, well, danger's past now. I really want to go to the hospital and check on the wounded.
Okay.
Right? So they're driving to the hospital, him and Sophie in this, his wife Sophie in this car, and Gabriel Princip, this 16-year-old kid that is trying to kind of earn his stripes with the Black Hand, is sitting there at a cafe going, oh, like, I missed it. I didn't miss my opportunity. And they're all trying to regroup to maybe try to do another attack before he leaves the city or something. And then here comes Archduke Franz Ferdinand, just pulls up right up to him, sitting at this cafe. And he just pulls out a gun, walks over and shoots them.
In a pistol or?
Yes, with a pistol.
Weird. Okay.
Yes. And then that sets off this chain of events to where...
Quick interjection. The Black Hand, what was their professed ideology?
They just wanted...
Anti-monarchy or...
Yeah, they wanted their independence back from Austria-Hungary Empire. They didn't believe in colonialism, which is totally understandable. But the wild thing is that Archduke Franz Ferdinand, like, he had already, like, kind of balked at the monarchy already, because his wife Sophie, like, she wasn't noble enough for the family. And so he was all about, like, that's who I love, I don't care if she's not royal enough. And he actually believed in giving them more freedoms. Like, he was the guy that actually would have wanted to give them what they were, like, wanting.
Nobody gives as much.
Their biggest proponent, absolutely.
In the aristocracy, mm-hmm. their biggest supporter. Mm-hmm. So they kill him. Mm-hmm. Does that young man get killed? Do they jump on top of him?
This is the wild thing also that I didn't know. I learned because as soon as we scheduled this, I immediately got very imposter syndrome. Like, oh my God, I haven't studied this in so long. What do I even know anymore? But he actually lives his life out in prison because he is a kid and they do not charge him as an adult in their court system. So he actually lives his life out in prison. Other people that were part of the attacks that were adults that, like, threw the bombs and things like that, they were sentenced to death. But Gabriel Princip is not.
He was just sentenced to life in prison from 16 till when he died.
Yeah.
How is that better? How is that?
I don't know if that doesn't seem.
Yeah, like, if they don't charge him as an adult, they should assume that he will not do things like that when he is an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe give it to him for 5 years till he's 21 and then let him out?
Well, by that point, this had led to the death of, like, 10 million people. So probably not.
Yeah, that's why I'm surprised they didn't just kill him. But, okay, so Ferdinand dies.
And then how does that make everybody else freak out?
Man, so it is like a part of this is literally what we're already like dealing with in our situation where like the monarchy is becoming less and less relevant. And so they start trying to create class warfare kind like battles between the nations in order to distract like the different kings and queens and stuff. Like they're sort of like pulling this like idea of like, oh, it's got to be Germany versus France to see who's the most modern of the countries. And they're starting to like set up fights so that they're fighting the people that based on nationalism.
Who do they declare war against? Who declares war first?
Austria declares war against Serbia. Serbia is, so this is all about like your friends go to war. So it pulls everybody in. So Serbia, Austria and Germany have an alliance, as well as Italy does says they're going to join. And then immediately is like, just kid, like, this is good. This is actually way bigger than, never mind. We're not going to, no, thank you.
Good for them.
Serbia and Russia, have
an alliance,
and Russia and France, because Germany has been starting to like up their military since they're on both either side of Germany, they have already gotten they had an agreement that if one of them, if Germany goes to war with Russia or vice versa, that the other one will be pulled in. So it's basically like these treaties that were already set up, pull everybody. And there were so many opportunities for people to like, just be like, no, we're not going to do it. But all of these people did it. Like
So Austria-Hungary declares because of what a group called the Black Hand, which was some sort of separatist organization.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Austria-Hungary declares war against Serbia.
Serbia is in bed with Russia and France.
And so Russia and France have to go to war with Austria-Hungary. Because they are their allies.
Right. But here's the other part that like a lot of people. So Germany is known as such a big player. And it's because Germany has actually been sort of like chomping at the bit to go to war. Because they are sort of thought prior to this, they are sort of thought to be like only about 25, 30 years before this, they were still like smaller factions, almost like tribes of people, like, not really unified. They were considered like bumpkins, like not a modern country. So they're like chomping at the bit to go to war to prove that they are like just as modern.
They're ready.
Advanced.
They're ready. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're civilized and like as, you know, powerful as France and Great Britain.
So and Russia and France go against Serbia. Wait, they're with Serbia.
No.
Go against Austria-Hungary. And who does Austria-Hungary get in?
German. They're with Germany.
Okay.
So those are the two main ones.
Those are the big factions. Yeah.
Yeah, technically Italy, but Italy sort of like bails at the last. They're like, just kidding.
Okay.
Right. I can't do it.
So when does the UK and the Turks, when do they get involved?
Right. Well, I don't even know. So the Turks is just like, I can't pull all of it. I don't remember the Turks. But the UK gets involved because Germany has been militarizing. And they're building a navy with the U-boats that is starting to actually cause the British Navy some like, which is their crown jewel. Like,
right.
They're starting to feel in danger from that. So they join in.
What about air battles between Snoopy and the Red Baron? What about that?
Yeah, so that is like possible, and they do a little bit of that, but we don't, it doesn't, and the Red Baron is there, but it's not at the level that it is like in World War II yet.
Oh no. It's very new, right?
Yeah, it's so new.
Okay. So
literally only 2 years old, and people are like, it's like 10. When did the first flight go up? 1903? I don't remember.
1906, 1903, 1906. Something like that.
So it's like 10 years in. So they don't do like air combat the same, a little bit, but not, It's mostly to drop shells.
Recon. Yeah. And recon.
Yeah.
Right?
It's not like the bombers that we saw. And we're not seeing like bombs being dropped on countries the way we do in World War II.
No, no, it's all very new. But so now, but we're in 1914.
Yeah.
And people have declared war upon each other.
Yeah. They're thinking this is going to be a quick little war. This is just to like show who's boss on the continent. We'll be home by Christmas, essentially, is like what the leadership is thinking.
Wow. Okay.
And they're going off of these military plans that were made 20 years prior as like a thought experiment. And every military leader is grossly underestimating. This is why the Great War is like so gruesome, is that the technology, they don't account for the weapons and the technology that they come up against. They've never seen this. Nobody's been to war for quite a while, like truly to war in quite a while.
Right. There's been like sort of these small battles that are like the Crimean War, I think, happened, and the Prussian.
Yeah, the Prussian whatever. Thing is like the biggest, last biggest thing, and a lot of them didn't even see that. Yep.
Yeah.
So the technology has just like skyrocketed at this point. So they don't realize like they're doing kind of old school, like again, yeah, like lining up battle, and then this like
old school, yeah.
And they really don't. Even all the plans were not, and this is true again in World War II. It's like they repeated the same thing, but they were not planning on, all these plans were not a two-front war.
Right.
Especially for Germany. So Germany, in order to attack France, does have to invade Belgium neutrality. They do it in World War I. They do it again in World War II. Because
Belgium is neutral.
It's neutral, and the best way for them to surprise France is to go up through Belgium and down into France. But both sides think like we're the like they're underestimating both sides. So they end up like, you know, really running into each other in northern France. Between the big players are France and Germany. And Germany has just been dying to like show that they're so powerful and strong.
Right. Okay, so the lineup I've got is June of 1914, Ferdinand is assassinated. July of 1914, Austria-Hungary declares war on Serbia.
Yeah.
And then August, Germany invades Luxembourg and Belgium. So this is all 1914.
Yep.
And then that's the beginning of August. Germany invades Belgium. Mid-August, August 10th, Austria-Hungary invades Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they start a two-front war immediately, even though Napoleon told them not to.
Yeah, they're also forgetting, like, again, they do it again in World War II.
Yeah, 25 years later.
Invade Russia in the winter. And winter is not, this is August, but it ain't that far away.
It's still winter. Yeah.
It's coming. It's so close.
Right.
They're leave thinking, Russia this will alone. Be done by winter. This will be done by winter. We don't, and then they're stuck. In the winter. The winter, invading Russia in the winter will get you every time. Napoleon tried to warn you.
Yep.
And you guys did not listen.
So early August is when British forces arrive in France.
Yeah.
So the nations allied against Germany were eventually to include Great Britain, Russia, Italy, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Rhodesia, Romania, Greece, France, Belgium,
US. That's just British Commonwealth. They can pull. Like, that's
Canada,
just British
Serbia,
colonialism.
India, Portugal, Montenegro, and Poland. And then Austria-Hungary invades Russia. And then the first battle happens in early September in northern France.
Yeah. And at this point, it's like, that's when they hit the, like, that's when they just come to a stalemate. Like, neither side can make any ground. And so in order to protect them, this is where trench warfare comes in. They have to dig in order to, like, create these trenches.
The
in
boundaries.
Order to, like,
we're on this side, you're on that side.
It's just protecting them from the gunfire and the artillery and the, like, machine gunning that they have not seen. Like, the weaponry they have not seen.
Yeah, yeah.
Before.
Oh, great, because everybody... The Gatling gun, I think, was invented in like the late 1800s. And now there's all these machine guns and stuff.
Yeah.
So
they just are like, and so they dig in. So it's most of the war is fought with
you
two.
You're mute now. Muted, but you're not muted.
You can't?
No, oh, there you go. You're back.
Okay.
You're back.
Just cut.
I don't know what happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. All right. Anyways, so they dig in, and this is where I find this, like, just life in the trenches is sort of like a, that's where I get, like, really, like.
Okay. So it's trench warfare is your dig.
I think it's really, it's a lot of, it's some of that. It's also the art that comes out of this. I can talk about, I'll talk about, like, the little, because you can't cover it all. So, so the number one thing that is my, one of my favorite things of World War One is the Christmas truce. Have you heard of this?
Pipes of Peace, Paul McCartney. Yes.
Yeah. It's not as like flowery, and this is something I talk about in my show as well, but the Christmas truce is where, on Christmas Eve, 1914, the Germans actually get Christmas trees sent to the front.
And they're like,
just from like the government even. And like they're lined up, and Christmas Eve is the big German. They love Christmas Eve. And then they're singing Silent Night in German, and the English start singing it in English across over the top of No Man's Land. And they actually like the next day are like, hey, like, let's just, these are still professional soldiers. This is not, they have not started drafting. So these people are like, kind of like, well, it is the holidays. Can we just like have a break? You know, like it's not really worth the pay we're getting to fight. Mm-hmm. So they're also like, that way we can bury our dead and reinforce. And they actually do that. And there's some, you know, people actually know each other from across the way, and there's some places where they didn't see it at all. There's other places where it happened, like, more than once.
Yeah.
Yeah. It happened all along, like at a lot of different places. And a lot of it had to do with like how close they, cause sometimes these are only 100 feet away from each other. Like they literally can have conversations, or they're like a couple, almost a mile apart. It just depends on where you're at. So it's not like a uniform thing, but there is like this, it lasted for like up to Boxing Day, like in a lot of places. So, I feel like there is a lot to learn. I wish that we could take note from that. Just in general, because they met
in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. They met in the middle. And they just were like, I do wish that even us politically now, like the right and the left, could just give it a break and stop trying to like destroy each other. And like, if we stop attacking each other, we can take a break and like fix our problems. But we're too busy doing that.
Right. But too many people, like literally every time we've tried to compromise,
someone's got
to. It's very hard to compromise with Gaston Mansplain, where he really desperately wants to show you how big his dick is and then punch you in the face and rape your sister. So, I mean, Nazis are hard. It's. And that rhetoric gets used against it too, right? Because of the, we don't negotiate with terrorists kind of thing, right?
Right. Well, and they weren't Nazis yet at this point, although like,
And whoever's talking gets, they did invade. Whoever says I don't negotiate with terrorists gets to define what terrorism is.
Exactly.
And so that can sometimes just be a woman who would like an abortion so she doesn't die, or that her life doesn't get to go her way.
Exactly. And to be fair, Germany was the one that had to like both propose this truce and be the ones that came up out of the trenches first.
To do the Christmas peace thing.
Right. And they actually like would have like joint burial sessions where all the soldiers from both sides and the like chaplains were there to give prayers and stuff. And there's this one story of somebody saying like, we will fight till freedom. On the German, that's what they wrote on their like headstone or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the French like soldier was just like, how can you be fighting for freedom? Like, we're fighting for freedom. And so it was like such this like thing is like, everybody thinks they're fighting for the same thing. And if
right.
we just
everyone's
stop,
been led misinformation.
Yes. And it's like the people in power setting up the dynamics for their own game.
Right. It's the Russian claim that they had to invade Ukraine as preventative maintenance.
Exactly.
The U.S. invading Iraq. It was somehow
exactly.
preventative.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's no, it's the lie you tell yourself to get over the border so that you can go steal mm-hmm. their whatever. If it's oil, mm-hmm. if it's, and in both Ukraine and Iraq, it was oil. So, mm-hmm. And grain, I think, Ukraine being a breadbasket, I think.
Yeah.
But what was it in France? I wonder what the Germans.
Well, it wasn't, it was literally like, so it wasn't resources in that way. It was literally for them to like, it was more ego than it was like a resource
anything
that
else.
They were after.
Interesting.
It was them
okay.
trying to prove their power because they had been sort of known as like these country bumpkins that, and everybody was like constantly saying like, oh, the Germans, like they are not as civilized or as advanced as us. And it was
right.
just very much about like ego. And there's also like, and I think if anybody's interested in brushing up on their World War One, I think the best book is called Rites of Spring by Modris Eckstein.
Okay.
And that is the idea, is that the leaders had emplaced this idea in their minds, is that the only way to become a civilized advanced nation is through this war.
Okay.
Like through death is rebirth sort of thing. And that's like Rites of Spring is sort of this idea. But like through death is reborn this stronger nation. And they really push this with the soldiers and they like believe it. It's actually like
right.
a lot of the mental stuff they did was very like The Secret before. It was like, if they believe they can, then they will sort of.
Oh, wow.
Things. It was like constantly like that kind of rhetoric of being like, well, in order to be this amazing country and to like prove that Germany should be so proud of itself, you have to prove yourself through war.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That seems like a good place to take a break. There might be an ad here, you guys. Let
Perfect.
Us wait for a moment and see if it happens. My ad. I'm about to do an ad. Hey, you guys, it's me, Jackie Cation. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Give online therapy a try at betterhelp.com/dork and get on your way to being your best self. That's real, by the way, getting on your way to being your best self. I mean, getting to know yourself, it's a lifelong process. And I have spent a lot of time doing that. Some navel gazing, looking into it, talking to people. And talking to people is literally, it's harder to lie out loud. When I did therapy, it helped me say out loud the things that needed to be said out loud so that I could grow and change, obviously, right? It's not the only thing to do, but it is incredibly helpful. So if you have been thinking about going into therapy and doing some therapy, BetterHelp connects you with a licensed therapist who can take you on that journey of self-discovery from wherever you are. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suitable to your schedule. And you fill out a brief questionnaire, right? And then you get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge, obviously. And I say this, discover your potential with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/dork today and get 10% off your first month. BetterHelp is spelled BetterHelp.com/dork. Let's get back into the show. Did it happen? We'll never know. Actually, we'll know because you listened to it. Welcome back. I'm talking with Christy Buckley.
Yes. Nailed it.
Yes. Nailed it.
It is actually very German. It just means little book. It's like booklet.
Little
in German.
Book. Booklet.
I know.
Little book is cuter than booklet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will say this is what I have been reading a mystery series set in
yeah.
between World War One and World War Two. And there's
I
been
love
a
this.
Lot there's been a lot of flashbacks to World War to the war. Our main character, an investigative, like she solves crimes and
mm-hmm.
she's also a psychiatrist. So, she's baller, man. And this thing is out of hand. It's set entirely in London from 1928. to the last one was written, I believe, in December 6, 1941. But the first three or four books are about World War One, because she was a nurse in one of the nurses' stations for the British during the World War. And conscription in... This is what I know about World War One right now.
I love it.
So the British started the draft, conscription, in January, like a year and a half into the war, January 1916. Prior to that, it was all volunteer army. And so...
Volunteer or professional soldiers. Yeah.
Right. And, but to get people to join, there was some weird right-wing lord and some left-wing suffragette asshat who started a group called Order of the White Feather. And they had young women in Great Britain walk up to any men ages like 16 and up, not in uniform, and give them a white feather and call them a coward.
Yep.
And so.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And it got.
It's very
so
much
many,
that mentality that kept this whole thing going.
This whole, the whole of World War One seems to be a big, like playground thing where you're just like, this is, you know, the, it doesn't have the chilling efficiency of World War II. No. It has a sort of this loosey-goosey, we don't know what we're doing. Oh, and here's some
chlorine
gas. Nobody's
asking, like, why are we doing this? Yeah, like, why? And it's very, yeah, it's very, like, pushing, like, really pushing on people's insecure, like, even individuals or country, nationalism, insecurity of, like, prove that you're not a coward, to prove that you're the best, and they really like do that effectively.
So amazing. Like, it's just like you said, it's all ego on every angle where you're,
it's
like,
so
well, this is
like the psychological stuff. Like, I can't really remember the details of battles or anything like that, but it's actually like the psychological stuff that how they got this to go. And then also, like, it also became a sunk, like, sunk cost fallacy of like, oh, well, you've already, we can't surrender. We've already lost too much.
Too big to fail? Too big to fail?
Yeah. This can't be all for nothing. This can't be all for nothing. And they think it's be quick, but then there's so much loss that eventually they're just like, we can't give up. And we did it again in Vietnam. We did it again in Korea. Like, we did it again in Afghanistan. It's like these people do it. That's the thing, is like these issues are like over and over, like repeated. But they really are.
Because they work, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, they work, I get. Yeah, it's, but it is, again, just even America had the hardest time in Afghanistan admitting, like, we can't be successful. And we did it. Like, it's when our ego is too big, that's what causes you to lose and to fail. And it's like, can we not learn this?
Well, and the weirdest thing about Afghanistan is, like, we went into Afghanistan and I knew nothing about Afghanistan, right? I had heard of it. I've seen a map. But I did not know. And I remembered that the Soviets were in it vaguely and that it didn't work. What I did not know is that in the 1840s or 50s, late 1840s and early 1850s, Great Britain was in Afghanistan for a dozen years and totally lost.
Yep.
They couldn't
win. Well, that was Vietnam, too.
Because
Vietnam had France in there before we were in there, and they were not successful.
Right. There's just a couple of countries that that cannot be, like, there's just not enough white people to really make this happen. So, it's so, and to learn nothing from it.
Over and over again is so wild.
Right, just to repeat, you know, history.
Yeah. So, there's a couple other, so a couple of the other things that I really just found so fascinating was trench warfare, but also, this is really the place where post-traumatic stress disorder becomes, like, they don't call it that, they call it shell shock, of course, but this is where it first medically becomes, because it's so widespread among these soldiers, it becomes some, like, they finally recognize it as a medical condition.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's so, it's like, I don't know. To me, it's
was
like,
it just called because of the noise, or what was it?
Shell shock. Yeah, they would just call it shell shock because they thought it was because of the noise. Like in the bombs that they would drop, they'd call them whiz bangs because it literally was like whizz bang. Like that was the like thing. But that's just the first time because of sort of. Global, like this is the beginning of globalization and technology and the media being able to like spread information a little more quickly, at least that like medical and how the just the size of this conflict really lets doctors see that this is like an actual medical condition that that people.
Right. Like, if like 100,000 people are experiencing it, how right. many? Do you know how many people died in World War One?
Yeah, 8.5 million.
Wow.
Men Holy died. Probably more, really, but like that's like the soldiers.
Soldier count?
Yeah. And like this, and that was something that like I really, I just found so also like horrifying in a lot of ways. It's like, only 2 million soldiers' bodies ever made it home to their families. So like 6.5 million, they were just buried soldiers. On the battlefield, and families were like, I guess I'll never know.
Right. I guess right. I'll just
and
go.
Obviously, this happens in World War II again, but they just hadn't seen it in at this level. Like in Great Britain, there were so few men of a certain age after the war, they just called it the lost generation.
Right. So there was like, because the U.S. didn't get in until 17, right?
1917, and it was, yeah.
So it was just
yeah.
a year.
And they got tired of their, yeah, they really like tipped it over the top, but they really didn't. That's also why we don't learn about it as much in America, is because it's not really considered like a truly American war. We just got a little bit, the Lusitania pulled us into it, but that happened early in 1915. So, but that was like, people were like calling for us to get involved. At that time. And then once trade barriers started messing with money and things like that, that's when they were finally like, okay, we'll come yeah, over the, and we'll the, get
there
involved.
Were block. I know there was a German blockade. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's fascinating about trench warfare? I mean,
trench
besides
warfare,
those peace things. Yeah.
Well, so I think it's, I think, and I don't know about, but it's a little bit, we use it even a little bit in comedy, right? With
okay.
like our, it's like a comic sensibility of like when you, I don't know if you, maybe you don't feel this, but I do think a lot of comics are like, oh, we've been through like, and this was, I liked this mentality before I ever was a comic, right? But like, sort of like, trench warfare is sort of like you just keep go. Like the only power you have is to just survive. And that is like, and so like just surviving is the only, sometimes it's like the only fuck you have left, but you do it just to do it. And it's sort of like the person to your left and your right is sort of like your,
that's your family.
They're the only ones that really gonna get it. Like gonna understand you after this, right? And so I sort of feel right. that sort of with just with comics in general, sort of we have this sort of like, oh, we've done the shitty shows, we've done, it's sort of like we've done the road gigs, we've set, it's not even close to the road, but it is that sort of mentality.
Right. Right. It's right? a much lighter version of that
of
sort
course,
of trench work.
Of course.
Because everything I know about the trenches is that it would rain and there would be nowhere for the water to go. So
yep.
they would get a lot of sort of fungus on their feet.
Yeah, they get trench foot, gangrene. There would be rats. There would be just horrible, nowhere to
go
to the bathroom. The disease
yeah.
that would spread. And just like, their ability to sort of survive even in the worst conditions. And like, also, I mean, probably disassociate is something I just really related to maybe just as a person that had like a tough childhood. I just think it was right. like, it was sort of a like, yeah, you just keep going because that's your only option. But they even would have like, it was like a morbid sense of humor in a lot of ways. So they would actually bury bodies into the side of the trenches at times because that was the only time way you could do it. And then like pretty soon a hand of the dead guy would be hanging out the side of the wall.
Would be exposed. And everybody,
everybody, as if you didn't, they would get superstitious, like you shake the dead man's hand. You know, say like, you know, hi, it's just like a very dark sense of like humor at a certain point.
Camaraderie.
And they also have this like sort of like, well, either you'll go up over the top and they'll kill you, or you'll make it to the next trench. Either way, you have nothing to worry about. So like they had this riddle that was very just like, either you'll die or either you'll succeed or you'll die, and either way you'll have nothing to worry about. And I think it's so dark. But it was just sort of something that I was like, that really like just resonated with me in a lot of ways. As a person who can worry about anything, it was sort of like, it could be worse.
It could be worse.
And the worst might happen, and that is death. And then you don't have anything to worry about. Right. And I do stick with that. Mm-hmm. Right. I still stick with that. Yeah. It's very dark. I get it. My friend is like, what's wrong with you? But it's like, yeah, I don't know. When you're stuck in a, like if you have an upbringing that sort of feels like, it is sort of like constant fighting, and you're just, your only ability is to just like keep surviving. Like it was very something I just related to a lot there. But and I also think, I don't know, I have this weird parallel of, I am getting really, this is like another thing, it is related, but it's not really, I'm getting more and more into like psychedelic therapy and what it can do for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay. Microdosing LSD. Yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
I've done MDMA, but you can do LSD or psilocybin.
Or mushrooms.
Yeah. Yeah. Mushrooms.
What is psilocybin and what is MDMA?
That is mushrooms. MDMA is ecstasy.
Okay.
And mushrooms. But I actually think I like, cause you can actually look at aerial photos of these trenches, and they're still there hundreds of years later. Like you can see them on the French landscape.
Not hundreds, but 100.
Yeah.
110. 110.
110. Hundreds. Yeah. 110. Okay. Excuse me. Thank you. 110, almost. Yeah. 110. But it's over 100 years ago. Thank you. But you can still see these trenches, and they're actually, they designed it so that they weave constantly so that if an enemy came into the trench, they could not just shoot straight down the line.
Yeah.
You know, like it would,
so,
it would cause, it would cause less damage. And so in my brain, like some part of me is like, man, that is really actually how like trauma works in our brains as well, is like we have these ingrained like neural pathways that like are basically like they get messed up because of trauma. Mm-hmm. And then like we overgeneralize and we over like, you know, we over
compensate
dangers and we overgeneralize dangers and stuff. And so it's like almost like literally the same thing on the earth. We can still see how post-traumatic like stress is like even on, like in these trenches almost to be.
Right.
So
the other thing I read was that they were like, you had to go over the, you had to charge, you had to go. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't go,
no man's land,
they would kill you. Mm-hmm. They would, there was a lot of people that were shot for cowardice and desertion.
Yep.
And then it was written, they were like written on their faces, no moral fiber.
Yeah.
And so again, lending itself to the fact that of ego, of just like all of these guys were just like, this is king of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't play it, you're a coward and we're going to kill you or we're just going to go die.
Yep. And also like they, to keep like the press had such a, this is the first time the press is like super lying to everybody as well. Cause the press is finally more organized.
They're organized. And they're doing exactly.
They're doing exactly what like. So instead of they didn't want anyone to know that there was a lot of mutiny and a lot of people saying no, we're not going to fight. So then they would say it was spies that were coming in and actually causing the trouble. So it's like a real Antifa. Jan 6th Antifa thing where they're like, oh, that was Antifa. That was, they were disguised as us. That we would never do that. And it's like that same.
Our guys. Yeah. Our guys we're 100%. Everybody's on the same. Cause I do know that there was a lot of protests here in the US and they were squashed pretty hard by pacifists. And there were, and if you also did sort of a, conscientious objection that became invented at that time, and you were ostracized or mocked for being a conscientious objector. Because if you were able-bodied, you were supposed to go over there and die. So what about the art that came out of it? There was
so the art,
books.
So that's a great point. Also, so like a couple things. There's a couple like stories just of artists that I love. The first one is Franz Marc, and he dies in World War I, actually in 1916, but he painted this painting called The Fate of the Animals in 1913, and he literally calls his wife and he goes, this is a premonition of the war to come, and he's like, I wish I didn't paint it, actually. And it's really like chaos, it really is. He actually had, it's one of those like missed like opportunity things too, but he's German, and Germany had actually started like signaling for these people who could probably add to the art and the artistic recording of the war and stuff. So he's actually has been pulled, like reassigned to be pulled from the fighting, and he just gets killed right before.
Oh, right, because they pull the artists out to create propaganda posters.
But he actually was using his art to paint the early camouflage. Like, so he was painting the stippling, like tarps, in order to create the camouflage for people on the front. Fate of the Animals, and so. And you can see there's a burnt mark there. So it's stored in a warehouse that actually has a fire a little bit after he is killed. And the friend actually was hired to restore it. And he could have done it back to its original thing, but he actually restored the image, but with that dark thing.
Oh, he left that to sort of lend.
There's no like
more gravitas
to it. And also just to be like, this is
it's
I think
part of
he just
now.
Thought, yeah, I just think he was like, it's part of it now. There's no like official reason as to why he did that, but he's just like, he chose, it was a friend of his that died, and he was like, yeah, this is what war does.
Yeah.
Like, I think is what he was sort of saying. So he restored that dark part. That wasn't anything, but he restored the original shapes and kept the fire marking on that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And have you read All Quiet on the Western Front? Have you, is it mostly just, what's the art that you like that came out of it besides that? Is it
so
also the writing
well,
and stuff?
Yeah. I like writing. That was the first thing in high school, reading All Quiet on the Western Front was the first time that I was like, whoa. Cause I think it was just, the fighting, because it talks about the fighting and how it gets pulled in. And it, like, my parents' divorce was really bad. And I think I just saw these people in power fighting and then pulling these soldiers, like pulling everyone else into their fights. And it was just something that I really was like, ugh, like
resonated.
I feel that.
Yeah,
I feel that. The other story that I really like is another artist named C.R.W. Nevinson. And he is to say, I think I resonated with this as well because he was disabled. He had like some rheumatoid arthritis and maybe some asthma issues, something like that. And he had a lot of shame because he couldn't fight because of this
of
rhetoric. And he tried to volunteer to be an ambulance driver on the front at the beginning. And he, but his health didn't let him do it for very long. So when he came home, the Department of Information made him an official war artist, because at this time we don't have cameras the same way we do. So still the artists are really a big part of recording what happened, essentially. So
right.
He comes home.
Did they send him into the trenches to record, to paint?
They figured because he had already been there and he'd seen it, because he was an ambulance driver that was taking soldiers from the front back to like medical tents and stuff. When he came home, and his dad was like a war correspondent type of person. So he was sort of like already connected. So they had kind of given him this job to be useful in the war, since you're disabled and can't fight, like how, you know, we don't want you to bring shame to the family or whatever.
But if you think about it, to be I mean, that's just, you're unarmed driving into the battle. That sounds like a real, wow.
Mm-hmm. So, but he comes back and he has this art show that he's supposed to show his art at. Yeah. So that one, the one that I really like is Return to the Trenches. But that's not even the story of this, but he has this art show and the government comes to sort of like preview it before it goes out to
for propaganda.
Exactly. And he has this painting called Paths of Glory, and it's actually very gray and very dull and dark, and it's just a painting of two dead soldiers, because he was like, this is the reality, like war is not glorifying. And they go, you can't show them this. And so he, instead of taking it down, actually puts censored on like some brown butchered paper and hangs that over the painting, so that when people come to the show, they're like, oh, they're not showing us everything. So instead of taking it down, he sort of has this like fuck you of like censored, they're not showing you everything.
Oh god. That's a gut punch.
Yep.
And the, but everybody, the name makes it, you know,
Paths to Glory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
And then his other painting, Return to the Trenches, it's very like, it looks like they're moving and it's like just soldiers and you can't see where they're going. You can't see where they're coming from. And the whole point of the painting, I have it on my wall as well, like, is to be, nobody ever stopped it. And because they did this ego thing and pushed it so hard. Yeah. Nobody ever stopped to say, why are we doing this?
Nobody questioned anything.
Yeah, nobody was questioning anything. They're like, if you just want to be a good German, this is what you do. If you just want to be a good, like, English, Frenchman, this is what you do. Yeah, and the whole point of the painting is to, like, stop when you're in motion and go, like, whoa, do I even want to be doing this? Is this, like, what is the best for myself? And, like, that is what I love. Like, that painting, I literally, like, try to live by it. It's just sort of like, whoa, do you want to be doing this? Like, so many people just get in motion and, like, they're, like, hate their lives and they don't go, like, what am I doing this
for? Self-propulsion, yeah.
Yep, it's, yep. So that's, like, the art that I, those couple stories are the ones that I'm always just, like, because there's very little, and you come out of World War One just, and all those soldiers are like, war is not, there's nothing. Like, there's no point. There's, like, all of this is bullshit. And they have that sort of sense for the first time. And I think they keep trying to, like, you know, re-energize it with all of these different conflicts. And it's just never...
Well, the weird thing is that they're all like 22 and 24 years old when they get out of that war. And then 22 years later, it's World War II. And it's all of their kids.
It's their kids or it's them. They're still so many of them are still so, have PTSD so bad. And they've never really reintegrated into society, that most of like the SS and the Einsatzgruppen, and the ones that go east and actually do really mass
the Germans?
Exterminations. They're older soldiers that can't do the frontline fighting. And they're just being given a job because they have literally not been able to reintegrate into society since the end of World War One.
Right. And that's why they're mad. And that's what leads to World War Two is the fact that World War One never really ended.
Yeah. World War One, they try to like basically shame Germany for the like, and forever. Make them pay forever. And that is so, and they're like, which is another lesson you can learn. It's like how yeah, you could make your enemy pay, I guess, but like, at what point is it worth? Because then it really fuels Hitler in his hate and his like desire to like really overtake the world at this point.
It's
like,
we'll show you
Germany is not to be shamed forever. We are going to like rise again, essentially. And that's like what.
Well, and the crazy thing now is that the Germans literally are on the track to being the good guys in World War III. Because they're the only ones that have ever, or the first, shall I say, to do reparations for the Jews and the Holocaust. And
they learned their lesson in a lot of ways.
Right. They learned a lesson, and that lesson was that this did not pay off. This is not something that they don't want to be. And they have been the joke for 60, 70 years. They are the, you know, Nazis are the German joke. And the Germans, there's some, it was a TikTok or it was just a meme where some American shitwit is by the Reichstag and does the Hitler salute, the Heil Hitler thing. Mm-hmm. And just some German dude walking past him just doesn't even stop walking, just punches him and keeps walking.
Yeah.
And the guy, and the American haircut just falls down. And, you know, and it's the problem with empire, you know, and power.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a German empire, to my knowledge.
No, they wanted one in order to like prove, I mean, that's what he was going for.
Right, because there was a British Empire and there's, you know, and then there was these other, you know, there was the Spanish Empire from the
Even the Austro-Hungary Empire, that was an empire that started this whole thing. That's why they were in Serbia and Franz Ferdinand got killed in the first place.
Right, because they wanted to create an empire. And because they knew that there was money in it, you know? There's money in the banana stand, you guys.
There is. There's always money in the banana stand.
Don't burn the banana stand down. Don't do it.
Yeah. But just as like a also fun fact, maybe just as a tie at the end, a couple of things that came out of World War One that the wristwatch, they didn't have that. Thanks, comedians everywhere. Thank you for our watch. They didn't have portable x-rays. Marie Curie did that. They did not have the vaccines that we have now until World War One, because they didn't need vast, like mass-produced vaccines until World War One. They also have sanitary like that was the first time women were involved in war on that level. The British women were brought in to be nurses and things like that.
Yeah.
And they actually didn't have like sanitary napkins the way we do now until then.
Like menstrual cycle?
They would just use cotton rags. But they figured out like this crepe. It was Kleenex. Also Kleenex is kind of the same. It's the same invention.
Brand?
But came from like dressing wounds and stuff like that. But like they found that it was like, better at absorbing stuff and
absorbing
also,
and then wicking away from, so you're not sitting in a pool of blood.
Yeah. So all of those, came out of World War One. We wouldn't have it. And also triage, like just that system of like prioritizing care didn't happen before then, which, we still are
Hell of a price to pay. Hell of a price to pay. But
yeah, too bad we had to even learn that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So but now the teachers in schools have it. So that's great.
Yes.
Have you heard about that? They've been teaching. Anyways, I'm okay. We can't. Yeah. It'll get too sad.
I'm fine. Okay. Well, Christy Buchele.
Buchele.
Don't do it. It's
okay. I wish it was Buchele.
Yeah, so do I. But no, I don't, because it's Buchele. It's your name.
It is.
It's a beautiful name. Everybody should find Christy Buchele. And when you're in Denver, you should go to Rise Comedy. You should look forward to seeing that Lost and Found. And if you go to the Joke Mentor, you will know when that goes up, and then you'll get to watch that.
It'll be part of the Denver Fringe Festival in June is the next time that show will be there, and I will hopefully be taking it all over the place. So, and you can see me talk a little bit more about World War One in there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you for letting me talk about this. Where else would I? No one wants to talk about this.
And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?